Hello and welcome to Modern American Diplomacy, a podcast exploring the lives and contributions of America's most accomplished diplomats. I'm Ben Reams, recording in Washington, D.C., and I'm joined today by Liz Mendenhall, a USAID officer serving in Jakarta. Today, we're very pleased to welcome Ambassador Liliana Ayalde.
I think no matter what the tour is, you need to enjoy what you're doing. And that passion comes across if people will notice. So you're more effective if you're enjoying what you're doing, if the people that your supervisor feel inspired and motivated, and that all works together.
Ambassador Ayalde had a 38-year diplomatic career that began as a USAID Foreign Service officer. Her last assignment was as the Foreign Policy Advisor and Civilian Deputy at the U.S. Southern Command, or SOUTHCOM, in Miami. Prior to that, she was Ambassador to Brazil from 2013 to 2016. And before that, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. She was also the Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Latin America and Caribbean Bureau for USAID. She was our Ambassador to Paraguay from 2008 to 2011. Prior to that, she was USAID Mission Director in Colombia, where she had responsibility for the Development Assistance Portfolio under Plan Colombia. She has also held assignments in Bangladesh, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Bolivia. All of our guests have won awards, but Ambassador Ayalde is in a class of her own, having been honored by the U.S. State Department, USAID, and DOD, as well as the governments of Colombia, Paraguay, and Brazil. One quick disclaimer, both Liz and I are Foreign Service officers. We are conducting this interview in our personal capacities, and any views we happen to express are our own and not necessarily those of the U.S. government. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you.
So I'll ask the first question, and then I'll let Liz jump in. I wanted to start just by asking a little bit about your upbringing and what got you interested in foreign assistance or foreign affairs. Which came first for you?
My father was a public health specialist, worked with the World Health Organization, the Pan American Health Organization. His first overseas tour was in Suriname and working on malaria. So I think I just grew up hearing about public health and working in the community level. And plus, we lived overseas through his assignments. And I enjoyed that, the idea of learning about different cultures and learning a different language. I got my BA in international service from American University and then proceeded to get a master's of public health in Tulane.
Just a quick follow-up on that. The Pan American Health Organization is, I believe, just up the street from the State Department. Was that where it was headquartered when you were younger?
That's correct. It was interesting. When I first joined USAID, it was in the State Department building. So I would actually commute at times with my father. Oh. So yes, they're neighbors.
Speaking of your first years in the Foreign Service, what were your first assignments overseas like?
Well, it was also very new. My first assignment was Bangladesh. I started with USAID, bringing with me the languages that I thought were my tools, both Spanish and Portuguese fluently and French speaking ability. So I felt very comfortable that I'd be able to communicate. And sure enough, I get assigned to Bangladesh, which just freaked me out initially because for me, communications was so key in learning and being able to listen, understand, and that first phase when you get to a different country. So actually, I was shocked and I couldn't understand, but eventually I did. And I'm glad that I got an assignment that was so different in terms of culture, in terms of language. I learned the language. At the time, it was easier, I guess, to get the agency to fund the training. And I got one-on-one for 6 months on Bangla and was able to arrive with just enough to impress people. So that assignment was so different, a single woman in a Muslim world, working on public health, which meant I had to travel around. It wasn't easy, so I always had to travel with a colleague. I would say he was my brother. And I was often the first white American in a community. So there was a lot of curiosity. And in a Muslim world, a lot of traditions and a lot of things that I could and could not do. But as a foreign female, I was able to navigate from being with the women in the communities that were in the kitchen and talk with them, as well as the men who were the leaders sitting outside and going about their business. So I felt like I was in this third culture. But it was all fascinating and, of course, also new. I was learning about AID, about how we fit in the embassy community and how we fit within the international community, because, of course, there's a lot of assistance was being provided to Bangladesh. So I was able to interact with the Canadian CETA, the Australian assistants, you name it, they were all there. So it was fascinating. It was a great post. It took me out of my comfort zone, but I learned a lot.
So I'm curious, with that experience and what you learned about fitting in with the different diplomats in the field and the different society than you expected and State Department, actually just curious about what your next assignment was like and how that might have shaped you further in your career.
My next assignment, interestingly enough, and I was called and I was asked to go to Guatemala. Hmm. And I thought to myself, I don't have to learn the language. But I think some of the skills that I did learn early on came with me as well. It's just dealing with people, dealing with your team. How do you incorporate the knowledge of your Foreign Service nationals, which for me in Bangladesh, I became close with and they taught me. And it was the same thing in Guatemala. So I think you continue to add to your toolkit as you move on and you learn you have different experiences in different posts.
And USAID officers tend to have longer tours than State Department officers. And did that affect your experience? Yeah.
Oh, yes, very much so. My first tour, because I was a junior officer, was only 2 years. So that felt very, very short. Because when I first started feeling like, okay, I know what I'm doing, it was time to move on. But that's more or less what State Department tours are like. So in Guatemala, I stayed for 5 years, and it was similar after that. So when I came back to state and I had to go back to the short tours, for instance, it was awkward because I felt, okay, now I can really get ahead and do things because I know the people. No one's going to fool me. I know what buttons to press. I know how to do this. And I said, okay, I'm ready to extend. And they said, no. 3 years is all you do. And then I realized, and I got a deeper appreciation for my State Department colleagues who would arrive someplace and then had to start thinking about their next assignment. And that takes a lot out of you because you have to then worry about where you're going to go next and work at it because these things don't come easily. Mm. So I saw the benefit. Now, the work is different, but the 5 year versus 2 or 3 years, it does make a difference.
So, I mean, it's been great hearing your first tours and the different things that you've picked up along the way. Have you had any particularly helpful mentors or other people that you've worked with, particularly in those early tours, who gave you guidance?
So I've been very lucky in having fabulous times mission directors or supervisors that turned out to be friends and mentors. And I think more than anything, when I think back, what was the one thing that they helped me with was I was very comfortable in my area. Let's say I started as a health specialist and I loved it and I did it well. And I managed programs that health and family planning, nutrition, all of that. But I think my supervisors saw in me early on my ability to work with people, to build teams, to inspire and motivate my team. So they would give me additional responsibilities. And I think that the one thing I learned, and now again, also based on my reflection, is how I was constantly thrown into things that were beyond anything I had thought of. So in Guatemala, I arrived as a health officer, and the way I was recruited was, okay, you're going to go there, and we don't have a very positive relationship with the government, so you need to close out the program. And that is your mission. And fairly soon, like usually happens, it was a democratically elected president, and all attention turned on Guatemala, a lot of funding coming from the different spigots, a lot of money. And I had to pivot. from managing a small program to a large program on the health side. But the mission directors kept saying, no, 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 we're going to put you in charge of this and in charge of that. And I kept saying, no, 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 that's not my area of expertise. So I think that it was Tony Cauterucci, these are very famous people in AID early on in the 80s and 90s, Chuck Costello, they saw in me the ability to grow. So I guess my first lesson there was sometimes you do have to move out of your comfort zone. But there were mentors that actually said, you know what, you're a good AID mission director, but we want you as an ambassador. And I said, what? I like what I'm doing. I was in Colombia at the time. I was just fascinated with my work. I could have stayed there for the usual tour, 5 years. I was there in my third tour and said, no, 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 we want you as ambassador. And I was confused because I liked what I was doing. I was doing a good job. But it was someone who then turned out to be a friend, colleague, and mentor who said, no, this is what you should be doing.
What you said is, I think, really impressive and very fortunate that you had mentors who pushed you, and obviously they were right in terms of what you've been able to accomplish in different aspects of your career. But I've been also thinking of some colleagues that I have, whether they're in USAID or whether they're civil service, and I feel like they often don't get pushed. And I'm just thinking of one in particular who's right now is thinking about stepping up and trying to help people in Ukraine, which is outside of her current portfolio. But she's been doing her portfolio for like 4 years, and I just would like to see her do that just to challenge her. So sorry for that diversion, but do you have any advice for those people who aren't being encouraged and how they should maybe think about it?
You know, I didn't raise my hand and say, I want to do this, but rather because you're doing a good job, you get noticed. And there's a certain passion to what you're doing. And like you just said with this person that you're talking about, you've noticed that. So you could encourage her and say, look, there are these other things that you could be doing because you're doing such a great job. This would be just a perfect next step. And people don't take the time. They're so busy. So it's just helping each other grow. And you do want the agency to succeed and you want state to succeed. So you want talent in leadership positions. And sometimes the system is not able to capture them. So as much as we could do for each other, the better.
That's right.
Yeah. I wanted to pull on a thread a little bit about what you just mentioned in terms of how your career has been varied and you've been able to see multiple sides of this foreign policy arena that we work in. So given that your experience at state and aid and also with DOD and the military, and particularly as ambassador, all of us see how important the interagency can be and how we're supposed to really be working together cohesively when we're out in the field and in DC, but certainly especially in the field. What lessons and observations do you have for us in terms of how we can do that better?
So I'm a strong believer in the interagency. I think we each bring something to the table. And we're stronger if we do it together. I had the direct experience of dealing with the interagency, I think most evidently in Colombia. It takes patience. As you well know, each agency has a different rhythm, has different objectives, a different personality, and a different culture. It's like with different countries. So articulating that takes some patience and some jiggering. It's not easy. The communications is different. So you have to invest in it. I think it's easier overseas because there are not as many issues out there and you can focus on a mission. So I think I'm a true believer of the interagency because we can't expect AID to do it all and we can't expect state to be as effective if we're not working together. But it is tough to do. And I think it's a combination of awareness of what each agency brings to the table and having the personality, because there's always the temptation by one agency wanting to lead. So it's calibrating this. And when do you push? When do you pull? Everybody wants to have the opportunity to shine. So it's this constant calibration that is exhausting. But at the end of the day, when it works and everyone trusts each other, then you forget about this platforming, and you just get the work done. So it takes a little bit of investment up front and doing your homework and then being able to work it so that everyone's working as one team and focus on the same objectives. So I'm a strong believer. And that was my experience in the case of Colombia. We, in fact, started to work this with the Colombians themselves, who were struggling in going into the territories that they have militarily recuperated, but then needed to have the governance part go in. And that meant it wasn't only the military, but it had to be working together with the administration of justice and the health ministry and the education ministry and calibrating all that. Here we were in an embassy trying to demonstrate that communicating, sharing information. And of course, there's always the tendency of having sensitive information that you don't want to share with each other. So those are all things that challenge you along the way, but you are focused on working it together is the key thing.
Just to quickly follow up on that point, my last post was Colombia. So I served there from 2014 to 2018. And it is, in fact, I think the strongest, most cohesive and positive interagency that I've worked with. It makes me wonder, hearing that it was like that when you were there as well, how much of that is that because of the complexities of the main issues in Colombia that we all focus on, that there's an ability to kind of focus on something a little more unified than being all over the place with our various priorities. And how much of it is also maybe that over time we have made some grooves in terms of continuing that positive engagement. Because the other side of it is I wonder how much of it ends up being just personality based, right? So it could be good for a tour and then all fall apart when a couple of the actors change.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of all that you've said. I don't think it was like that when I arrived. In fact, that was my challenge. And the ambassador at the time says, make this work because we've got some issues. So that became my mission. It was a tremendously intense time. So we had no time for weak links in the system, meaning everyone had to pitch in. So you create that environment of excitement. And that was one thing, that was internally. And then it makes a difference when the government is organized, right? So we had a counterpart that had a very clear mission and a very clear priority. So they rolled up their sleeves with us together, and we were talking about the same issues. I've been in situations where we may have an agenda, but the government has a different one. So it's not synchronized. So that makes it very different. And when you have that compatibility, it makes a huge difference. So there's been the Plan Colombia and the follow-ons that's been able to frame exactly what we want to accomplish. And between the embassy community and the government, there's usually consistency. But I do think that this gets built over time. And I agree with you that personalities make a big difference. Because if the leadership doesn't believe in it, then it starts falling apart. So I think that's what's important. And I got this from when I started. My ambassador at the time said, everyone's working together. We do not have time for this, the bad apples. So I think it needs to come from the top. That way of working is instilled from the top. And it depends on the personality. Sometimes it works, it clicks. And sometimes you may have a situation where the teamwork is not as easy. You need to work on it and people leave and then it starts from scratch. So you build on it.
I will say that my first experience with working intensively with USAID was in Mozambique. So I guess that was like 2010. The mission there in terms of personnel, budget, and even, by the way, a separate office was much larger than the U.S. Embassy. So that was a unique experience. So I'm envious that leadership gave you a clear direction saying you're going to make this work, because I've also seen it not work so well. But the question that I'd like to ask, though, is how you applied those lessons in your next assignment to Paraguay, which would have been your first ambassadorship, what you thought about how to take those leadership lessons and put them to work?
Well, I'm a strong believer in the team approach. So I think that is a lesson that I take with me everywhere in government and outside of government. And it was an exciting time because it was a totally new government, meeting the first leftist-oriented government in a country that's very conservative, that had had 60 years of the Colorado rule. So it gave me a real opportunity to get in there in a very different environment, where there was a lot of distrust of the government by the general public, by the private sector. And the role of the U.S. coming in, or the U.S. ambassador, was everyone was looking to see what would be done. I mean, it wasn't planned, because at the time of my nomination, I don't think the person had been elected yet. But as it turned out, it was a former bishop who was very interested in fighting corruption, working on health and education, job creation, issues that AID, it's their bread and butter. So having conversations on these issues came very naturally. And I think my AID experience was very useful in generating that credibility with the leadership. And now we had a small team in terms of the interagency. Colombia has, I don't know how many agencies at this point, but above 20. And there we may have had 10 or so. So I thought it was, for me, an excellent transition, because I had managed missions much larger than that in terms of staffing, in terms of issues. Bolivia had over 200 staff, 250. The budgets were huge. And there, it wasn't so much about the money. It was more about managing the relationship. And that's what I like to do. So I couldn't have planned it better, walking into Paraguay at the time I did.
That sounds great. As I'm listening to you sharing your story and your experiences in between mentors, suggesting that you take on roles that you maybe weren't ready to think about for yourself, and then how, when you look back in particular, I guess, the sequencing of the different positions you've had kind of works out in a way to keep building on itself. So when you, as a state and an aid FSO here on the line with you, I guess, what advice would you recommend for either, for both of us, in terms of what's that one kind of tour that you should really do, or ways that we can think about exposing ourselves to having a fulfilling and well-rounded FSO career?
Well, I think no matter what the tour is, you need to enjoy what you're doing. And that passion comes across and people will notice. So you're more effective if you're enjoying what you're doing, if the people that your supervisor feel inspired and motivated, and that all works together. So no matter what you have, whether it's small or big, and I had Paraguay, I was delighted to have Paraguay, and it's a small mission, but it was a wonderful opportunity for me to work the relationship at a time that everyone was very skeptical. At the time, countries in the region, because the map of the Western Hemisphere was very leftist, a number of our missions didn't have a chief of mission because their ambassador had been kicked out. We didn't have an ambassador in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Nicaragua, I think in Bolivia. So I was told, okay, you've got to make this relationship work, because we don't want you to be kicked out. And boom, of course, WikiLeaks explodes. And because of the relationship I had built, the president said, okay, I see what you wrote about me, but don't worry, we won't kick you out. But anyway, the point is that it's hard to say this is the type of mission you need to go to, or this is the type of position. But whatever position you end up being at, you need to like what you're doing, because if you don't, it's going to show. So you need to be passionate about what you're doing. You need to care about your people. You need to, at times, maybe take risks and do things that are out of the box, but it's to demonstrate that you could do more than just the routine. There's more that can be done, and to look for those opportunities to shine. So it's not a particular post, I would say, because I didn't search for those positions. It just happened to be. Look at where I was in Guatemala. I was there to close it out. Who would go to a mission to close things out? But I thought, oh, okay, this is where they want me to go. It makes sense. So I think you never know. And you can make it. And sometimes if it doesn't work out, well, you do a good job and you move on to the next. But I think that making the best of what you have and taking care of your staff so they can shine as well overall, it's managing it in the right way and strategically providing that creativity that you need to be strategically important in what we're trying to accomplish in that particular country.
I would like to ask a question about your next ambassadorship, which was to Brazil, and what that transition was like, because my impression, based on just visits, are that Paraguay is a really fascinating but very small landlocked country, and Brazil is just this massive giant of Latin America. And, well, a different language, but a different working environment as well, a different media environment. So what was that like, and what sorts of shifts did you have to take in your approach?
So it was fascinating. First of all, again, I was not looking for it. I had just come back from having some medical leave. I had breast cancer, so I had been out of commission and was asked by Roberta Jacobson to become the DAS at State, and had been very happy doing that job because I was just getting back into the swing of things after my medical leave. When I get the invitation to be nominated as ambassador to Brazil, and I was initially shocked because it was not in my plans, and because my daughter was going into her senior year at high school. So I checked with the family, and they all were very excited, luckily so. I was excited because as a child, I had lived in Brazil, which had given me the Portuguese, sort of a native Portuguese, because I was there for 3 years as a child, and as a child, it's very easy to learn the language. So it was a very exciting time because President Obama had invited then-President Dilma Rousseff to a state visit, and they needed to accelerate my arrival. We didn't think it would happen very quickly, but it did. So that was a surprise. So it was very exciting times. But by the time I was going to be sworn in, the Snowden disclosure issue had exploded. And the Brazilian president, Dilma, felt personally affected by this. And the relationship turned from the best historically between Brazil and the United States to the worst. And I arrived in that context. So it tested many things. And I was very happy that I had served as ambassador in Paraguay. That gave me the experience of serving as a chief of mission. Now, it's very different in Brazil because we had three consulates. The one in São Paulo was very big, issuing over 1 million visas a year and a lot of commercial engagements. And a lot was being prepared for that state visit, but it all came down. And the president, Dilma, said that there would not be any political engagement between our two countries. So I arrived, our staff was very demoralized, confused, and I had to rebuild. I had to work a relationship. And I found that to be challenging, but I like to be able to construct that, to build the trust. It was tough, but we had the Olympics, we had the World Cup, so we used a lot of sports diplomacy. The Brazilians are very proud. So you have to navigate the foreign ministry very carefully. They are very attentive of their sovereignty. We would get agendas from Washington, and how do you transmit those talking points is important. So it was polishing different skills. Fortunately, I had the language. The language helped tremendously because the Brazilians are very proud of their language. And the fact that I didn't have to speak English and transmitting tough messages helped bring us closer and helped navigate some very tense moments early on in my tour. But again, I think we used the sports diplomacy as a way of trying to make things work. This was the time that Vice President Biden was asked to work in improving that relationship. So it was a fascinating time to be there because the relationship had to be rebooted. And there were some things that I learned that no matter what the politics, Brazilians and the United States have a lot in common. Brazilians love the United States. They love to come to visit. They love our schools. They admire our technology. and U.S. business needs to be in Brazil because it's such a large market. So things work despite the government. And it's more helpful if our governments speak and have similar agendas because we can advance faster. But the people-to-people part of that relationship was something that really stood out to me. And that's what I devoted a lot of my time to, talking with students and engaging with the youth and other parts of society, the private sector, that doesn't fully depend on government. Of course, there are things that are critical that the government can help.
That's really fascinating to me. And I'd like to know more of what you think about what Americans should know about Brazil, is I think that we have a lot of ignorance about the country. I mean, speaking for myself, didn't really understand anything about Brazil until I had traveled there. But for example, you mentioned Dilma, the president, and now we have Bolsonaro, and it seems Brazil could swing back to Lula. And these are such major extremes. I mean, Dilma came up as sort of radical, and Bolsonaro is far in the other direction, is very pro-military. And yet, I think most people's impression of Brazil is this easygoing, open, samba playing, soccer playing, beach society, which it's way more complex than that. So I'd just like to know your thoughts on that. And also just in that context, where Western Hemisphere, Latin America falls into the geopolitical spectrum, and should we pay more attention, or is benign neglect possibly a good thing for some of the relationship?
So those are lots of themes, but very important themes, actually. Yes, I think there is an ignorance on Brazil, and not only in the United States. I think there's the sense that in Latin America, there's a sense, oh, it's Brazil. Oh, yeah, we can speak Spanish and we'll get by. So I always tell the Latin Americanists, just be careful. Portuguese is a totally different language. And Brazil is not like the rest of Latin America. It's very, very different. So I do think there's a lack of understanding of Brazil, and there's this tendency by many, and this is not only America's, to lump it. Oh, it's Latin America, and then Brazil's part of that. It's just a different history, and it's more like the United States, if anything. And this is because we've got similar values. We're both large economies, both large democracies. There are a lot of similarities, just like there are differences, but there are a lot of similarities between our two countries. I mean, someone would come and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to come to Brazil and I'll stop by and visit. Don't realize that the country is huge. I'd say, look, you're talking about going to New York and stopping by in California. It's just the same dimension. And the differences, the difference of the Northeast from the South. Paulista is very different from Carioca, from someone from the Northeast. And I applaud when there are centers of studies and there are issues being discussed on Brazilian politics or just things in general that are Brazilian, because I think there's a lack of that. And I think there's a little bit more curiosity now that you have a Bolsonaro and the possibility of Lula coming back and all of that. But there's not enough. So the more that we could see people writing about it, talking about it, I think the better. I think there is, unfortunately, so many issues in the world. And in the recent history, there hasn't been, besides Venezuela and the conflict in Colombia, there hasn't been an open conflict across borders in the hemisphere. So the attention has been not as robust, as I would say. Very little in the region would go a long way. Certainly during the war in Afghanistan, I would say if we could only have one day of the resources in this hemisphere, we could do so much. We could do so much on technical exchanges and people exchanges that do so much to bring the region together. And I think there are markets and so much that can be done. But I'm not as optimistic that because we do have war in Ukraine, we have a lot of issues with the post-COVID, the economies have all suffered, everyone's looking inward. But I'm troubled by the constant sliding of the region because there are other things that are troubled regions that take up the bulk of the attention. But I think there are lots of positives and lots of potential areas of doing things together. despite that at times it's not easy. It's not easy to work with Brazil on the business front because of their taxation and just their complexities in logistics. But imagine the market. I mean, that's why we have so many of our corporations and businesses there. So the opportunities are tremendous, and we just haven't fully captured that.
For all that's going on in the world right now, it's easy to pull our resources and our attention to other areas. Right now, it's predominantly with Ukraine, and we're still fighting COVID. But putting that aside, resources and attention span weren't an issue for the time being. What would you suggest the U.S. role in the Western Hemisphere be? So how should we be looking at our southern neighbors from a foreign policy standpoint?
Yeah, I think it's a question of sitting down with them and not making it a single issue relationship. There's the sense in talking to my colleagues in the region that our foreign policy is now focused on migration. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's an important issue because it's an important domestic issue. But I think we need to be careful about not only focusing on that, or the perception, again, is that we may be doing other things, but the sense that it's predominantly on that. I think there's certainly a lot that we can do on the commercial side. And I am a strong believer in commercial diplomacy because it's good for our own economy and it's good for their economy. And if we get a strong and prosperous region, we'll have a more healthy region. And that works for us both ways. In some ways, the issues with democracy today, where people don't feel that democracy is delivering, has to do with the lack of employment, and therefore inequities grow. There are things that we can be doing together in terms of our markets and that would generate employment that could be win-win for both us and for the countries in the region.
So I guess to wrap up, I'll have one final question. Ambassador, as somebody who's worked as a USAID officer and as a State Department officer and worked closely with the military, you've seen life out in the field, you've seen life in DC, and I'm curious if you have any final words of wisdom or thoughts for that whole range of US government actors out there in the field especially.
I guess I would go back to one of the questions that you alluded to earlier, and we didn't quite get to it, is the lack of understanding by the general U.S. public on what foreign affairs is, what we do, what is USAID, what does the State Department do overall. And I think we each have responsibility to try to do what we can to share our experiences. I'm trying to do that now. I felt very privileged to have had the career I had. So I want to be able to share that and to be able to expose myself to the high school students who are the freshmen at college or even graduate students. What's it like? What is it? Why do we care about what happens in the world and global issues? And what is it to be a diplomat, a foreign service officer? What's the difference between being a USAID officer and a State Department or other agencies that work internationally? So I think that everybody should look for ways of doing their part, sharing their experience, whether in their neighborhoods or more formally, of what the Foreign Service is all about, why foreign affairs is important, and what we can do as individuals to advance things that ultimately are in the interest of the United States.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Yalde. On behalf of all of our listeners, sincere thanks for joining us today. Thank you, Liz. This episode was brought to you as part of a Una Chapman Cox Foundation project on American diplomacy and the Foreign Service. The Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training, or ADST, manages the podcast series. If you're interested in exploring a career in the State Department or USAID, please visit careers.state.gov or careers.usaid.gov. To find out more about the practice of U.S. diplomacy, please visit UC Cox Foundation or the American Academy of Diplomacy. Please take a moment and rate and review this podcast so that other folks interested in foreign policy and careers in the U.S. government can find us. If you have questions or suggestions, please contact info@adst.org. Thank you very much.